In 1907, five cars set out from Peking on a journey from Peking to Paris. Only four cars completed the trip. This year, 165 cars recreated that journey. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Fritz James and Lang Whiteman from Des Moines made that journey in a restored 1929 Ford Phaeton. They drove through China, Mongolia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Iran, Turkey, Greece, Italy, and France on some of the worst roads, if you want to call them that, in the world. I'll talk with them about their adventures. Then later, we'll find out about a group of women tapped by the U.S. government to be human computers during World War II. The story of these women is told in the new documentary, Top Secret Rosies. I'll talk with Leanne Erickson, the director of the film. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1907, five cars set out from Peking on a journey from Peking to Paris. Only four completed the trip. This journey was recreated in 1997 and again in 2007. And this year, 165 cars recreated that journey. Fritz James and Lang Whiteman from Des Moines were among the drivers who made that drive. They drove in a restored 1929 Ford Phaeton, and they are here with me today. Hello, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for coming in. And Fritz, let's start with you. You and Lang must be very close friends to even contemplate this kind of an adventure together. How long have you known each other?
Well, I think about 40 years. and we met each other when we were pretty young. And we've done a lot of things together. One of the things we've always wanted to do is a rally. We've talked about taking a car and just driving it north as far as you can go. And we talked about doing a press-on regardless rally. And we just never have done it. So we waited a long time, and we thought this was a great opportunity, and off we went.
So did the two of you share an enthusiasm for old cars, or how did this whole idea come about? Lang?
Yeah, we do. We've both had different cars through the years, and as Fritz said, that one of our ideas of an adventure was to jump in a car and drive north as far as we could go, perhaps Hudson Bay or somewhere, just to see, you know, how far we could go. So the adventure talk had always been automotive.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. That's one of the things that both of us have in common is just interest in mechanical things, and certainly interesting cars are part of that.
When did you first hear about the Peking to Paris rally?
Well, we heard from our friend in Zurich, Switzerland, who was a bookbinder, and he had organized a group of Swiss drivers to take their cars and recreate that trip. And we're not really sure where we heard about it, but we know that that was the first inkling we had of it. And I asked Lang if he'd like to do that, and he said, sure, be great. Sounds great. Well, we were pretty naive at that point. We had no idea what this was going to be about. But we went on the website and decided to sign up for it. And I think we were one of the few first to sign up for it. So that was 3 years ago.
So the first time this journey was recreated in 1997, it was done again in 2007. And then again this year, is this only the third time that it's been done?
As far as we know.
I have so many questions about why anybody would do this. So why was this recreation organized, do you know?
Well, it's part of the organization's actually in England that presented it, was the production people for it. And they organize rallies around the world. And it's a competitive event, timed from each day and timed during the day to be from one point A to point B at a specific time. This is the fourth rally, and each one has had a different route. Also, the route we took was the first time that it's been done.
When you agreed that you would do this, you said you were a little bit naive, but you immediately signed up. What kind of a commitment did you have to make when you signed up to be a part of this?
Well, we had to get a car for one thing, and the first thing I did was I looked on the internet and I bought a 1935 Ford two-door coupe. And Lang and I looked at that car. I mean, it arrived in Des Moines. We'd never seen it before. We arrived in Des Moines and after a while, we thought, well, it's too heavy, too confining. There's just one seat and a cab. And there wasn't a lot of room to store things. So we kind of agreed that we were going to look on the internet again and to find another car. And we found a 1929 Ford Phaeton. And happily enough, I was able to sell the 1935 Ford for what I put into it. And we started working on that car 2.5 years ago.
How did you narrow it down to what kind of a car you wanted to drive?
Well, we were looking at the route itself. Again, we were very naive about this, but we were looking at the route and recognized that the road conditions were going to be not good. And we wanted to find a car that that would be able to finish. And we thought about the early cars, and the 29 Model A came up for several reasons. One, it's a very simple car, and if it needed to be repaired, that's a relatively easy thing to do. Also, the car was built during an era when the roads in the United States were not good either, and the car had to be built so it would go through muddy roads and through ditches and all sorts of things. And we thought that that's what we would be going through, is through river crossings and through sand and all sorts of things. The Model A has really high ground clearance. It's a sturdy car and light and pretty nimble, actually. So that's pretty much the reason we settled on that car.
And you
we always heard that farmers would keep an old Model A out by the barn in case they'd have to get to town in the spring, go through the mud and the bad roads. And that kind of sold us on that idea, too. And the engine in a Model A is almost like a tractor engine. And we kept it very stock.
And you bought this car on the internet, so you hadn't even seen it before you got it to your,
no,
your to Des Moines.
True. It's right.
That seems like such a tremendous gamble.
Well, we talked to this gentleman that was 84 years old, and he sounded very, very honest, and he sounded like he really knew what he was doing. He had the car for 20 years, and he sent it to a friend of his who was a rebuilder, and they spent 3 or 4 years rebuilding it. And we were so lucky because the car was immaculate when we got it. We sent it to Pennsylvania to a young man that we'd met on the internet to rebuild the car, and we chose the right car. We chose the right person to rebuild it, and it was just really blind luck.
So when you signed up for this drive 3 years ago, how did your families react to this idea? And Fritz, why don't you go first?
Okay. Well, when they found out that we were going through all these countries, and especially Iran, everyone joked that we'd be used for target practice as we went through, which was farthest from the truth. But the length of the trip was, you know, pretty ominous. For 37 days, we were on the road. And, of course, we had to be gone for almost 2 months. So Lang and I are in business together, for one thing, and we'd never been gone for 2 months from our business. And at the same time, that's a long time to be away from your family. But they were supportive. They were. And I think really down deep inside, they didn't think we were really going to do it. They just thought maybe we were talking about it.
That's exactly right. We've floated a lot of stories through the years, at least I have, about adventures to do, and they've always passed by. And I think most of my friends and my family figured, well, this is just another idea that's come up, and it'll go away. And the closer it got, the more my friends and family started to think, you know, are you guys really going to do this? You know, is it going to be safe? Is it going to be, you know, are you going to be okay and things like that? And the closer it got, the more those conversations came up. But I guess because of our naivete that we said, of course, it's going to be fine. And it was. It was more than fine. It was outstanding.
So you guys are in business together, and that's the bookbinding business. And you mentioned earlier that it was a bookbinder who put together the rally. Is this something that bookbinders do?
No. they never do it. No, our friend in Switzerland is a very adventuresome, creative person. And he's one of the best bookbinders in the world. And he's very innovative, very innovative. And we took a trip there one time, and I told him that going through his bindery was one of the best days on earth for me, because it was such a wonderful experience to see. He had an architect design his building, and everything about the whole thing was just great. But he got into, he found that there must be something else to life beside bookbinding. And what we do, we have a company that supplies materials for bookbinding. So we don't do bookbinding anymore, although both of us have been bookbinders in Illinois.
Well, I thought maybe I was uncovering the secret underground adventure world of bookbinding.
No, not exactly.
Well, let's talk about the trip. So you set out on September 10th. Tell me about that day.
Oh, that was very interesting. They let us first of all, we had to get from downtown Beijing to the Great Wall, and the traffic in Beijing. Luckily, we kind of made a caravan to there, but there were so many trucks and so many cars. It was really a hard trip, and we got to the Great Wall, and then they took us to the we had a sort of a ceremony there, and then if I remember right, we went to the border. Is that correct, Long? We went to the border, and then we just took off into the desert. And it was quite a departure. That's what I can say.
Yeah, it was a rally, and we have zero experience when it comes to motor rallies. There's a lot of things involved with it, the standpoint of really pretty sophisticated GPS systems to a whole language in three volumes of directions and route books that we had to follow to ensure that we didn't get lost and didn't take the wrong turn. And it took us a couple of weeks really to become halfway comfortable with all the things that went on within a rally. And what we did was actually start off with the most difficult rally that's ever been organized. The organizers told us that after the event was over that they'd organized 60 rallies before this, and this was by far the hardest one they'd ever done. So we had jumped off the deep end, and we spent 3 days in China going through the countryside, talking to people, getting through the various huge cities there, all by this GPS system and a route book. And it was a real handful at first.
Yeah, there were no maps. We followed an arrow, and a lot of people say, well, GPS system, you know, that's great. It tells you where you're going and all that. All this did was sort of give us a colored line, and the arrow was following the colored line. And there was also put in there waypoints. The waypoints, the GPS system would actually count down toward the waypoints. So if you were going the wrong way, it would start counting up, and that you knew that was wrong. But it's kind of hard to believe that we got all the way across this whole thing with an arrow pointing in the right direction and a route book that just told us what to do next, which wind to turn, how far to go.
And what kind of roads were you traveling on in those early days? And we just have a moment before the break. Just describe them briefly.
Well, they were the worst roads on the planet. And it did everything to do to just try to destroy our car. And it did destroy many cars. I mean, it would break the suspension systems and break the axles. But our car was so well prepared. I think we were probably one of the best prepared cars in the whole rally. We strengthened things. We really thought about it very carefully with our rebuilder. And the car held up, but many cars were just destroyed by the roads. They were so full of potholes, and sometimes Lang and I would find ourselves banging up against the roof of the car.
Well, we'll talk more about that drive in a moment. I'm talking with Fritz James and Lang Whiteman from Des Moines, who recently returned from the Peking to Paris car rally. We'll talk more in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today I'm talking with Fritz James and Lang Whiteman. They're both from Des Moines, and this fall they went on a very long journey by car from Peking to Paris as part of the Peking to Paris car rally. They did it in a 1929 Ford, and we've been talking a little bit about that journey. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Right before the break, we were talking about how incredibly bad those roads are that you took across China. Before you set out, what did you do to prepare yourselves to be able to drive a 1929 car on the world's worst roads? Lang?
Yeah, that was part of the thing that we didn't understand, is we thought that getting in our car and driving on the gravel roads down to the Missouri border and back, that we'd actually accomplish something. And it did, actually, but still it didn't foreshadow what we were really going to be involved with. The very first day in Mongolia was a time trial that you start off and go a certain distance for a certain time, And all of a sudden, we realized that we were not in Iowa any longer. We were in another, in a foreign place, and the car was just jumping. And we'd never experienced anything like that at all in our little trips down to the Missouri border and back.
You said that basically you have a GPS route and you have an arrow that points you along the way, and these roads sound so bad. Can you even see the roads in all the places?
Oh, sure. You could see the roads. They were like trails that went, and sometimes there would be four or five trails. And on the route book, it would say, choose the best trail, choose the best route. So we'd have to look at that, glance up ahead of us and say, okay, we're gonna go right. So the navigator would then prepare for that, and you bounce along up there for a while and decide that was too rough, and then you go back on another one.
This journey was broken up into day trips. Every day you'd travel from one spot to another spot, a specific amount of mileage. How long did you usually spend on the road each day?
Well, they were long days. We would spend from 7 o'clock in the morning. I think our longest one was from about 6:30 to almost midnight, going 25, 35, 40 miles an hour. And it is a long time in a car, no question about it. But it's a different type of long time. When you drive from, say, Des Moines to Denver, it seems like it takes forever to get there, and it's just it's kind of a boring event. And you spend 10 hours in the car, and you're half cooked when you get to Denver. Well, 12 hours in a Model A in Mongolia or Kazakhstan or somewhere is a whole different thing because of all the things you're seeing. The time passes pretty quickly, actually.
When you arrived at your destination each day, what kind of conditions were there for you to sleep in to rest up for the next day's journey?
Well, sometimes it was a 5-star hotel. So these were all provided for by the organization, and we'd prepaid for that whole thing. So sometimes it was a really nice hotel, and we had a huge parking lot where all the cars were stored. And for 12 or 14 days, we stayed in tents. On the steppes of Mongolia, which was a beautiful green, grassy place, and then rivers going by, and you could see the mountains in the background. And there was just no one there. We just set up our tents. There was an organization that called the Nomads, and they were a catering group, and they had very, very large German trucks, and they brought all the food and tents and everything. So we were really well taken care of. We had showers there. They pumped water out of the river, heated it up, and gave us showers. Crude, but good. And they set up restrooms for us and fed us. And the food was always very good. We never went out without food except at noon. And at noon, we had to provide our own food. And mostly, Lang and I had peanut butter and jelly and peanut butter sandwiches and water.
Whenever you could find a place to pull over?
That's right.
Exactly.
Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, there were 165 cars on this journey. Some of them were very late model. They're these support vehicles that were going along, the 2010 vehicles. But you guys were driving a 1929 Ford. What were some of the other vehicles that you saw along the way?
Well, they're beautiful cars, Lagondas, Bentleys, Rolls Royce. We had a friend who decided to take his wife on his 40th wedding anniversary. And he chose a 12-cylinder Rolls-Royce, about of 1935 or 36. And we questioned his wisdom in taking his wife for a 40th wedding anniversary across this trip. But they had fun. We got to know them real well. They had fun, and they had 21 flat tires during the time, which stressed the relationship. She told me that she said, "I've said things to my husband I've never said in 40 years."
You really get to know a lot about a marriage at that point. What I noticed in looking through the list of participants is that there were not a lot of women on this trip.
That's true.
Seemed to be mostly a male trip.
There was only one team of it was two females. However, there were a lot of cars that were husband-wives or husband or friends. So there were mixed groups. There was one group that there one team that was on their honeymoon, and they were in a 1919 LaFrance fire truck. It was a converted car. It was a fire truck originally, and it was converted over to somewhat of an automobile for the event. So there were a mixed bag of people there for sure.
You mentioned all the flat tires on that Rolls Royce. Your car performed unbelievably well. Tell us about how your car coped with this.
Well, we we decided to ask an expert about tires. We went to the Corker Tire Company over in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and we asked them what to do. And they said, well, there's a tire that called Excelsior Competition tires, and they're a little bit taller than your tire and a little bit wider. And we put those tires on our car and really heavy-duty Michelin tubes. And I think what happened was the extra size of the tire allowed the took a little bit of stress off the suspension system. They were also heavy duty, so we for some reason we never had a flat tire. And every day I would announce to people that we never had a flat tire, and Lang would always go, "Duh, be quiet about that because that's we're going to have one tomorrow."
Every day he did that,
but we never had a flat tire.
Well, and it's nice that the other teams who suffered from a lot of flat tires didn't decide to take revenge on that announcement.
Yeah, for sure. They kidded us a lot.
Yeah, good. I think that from the standpoint of the preparation of the car, that was the most important thing because we were really babes in the woods when it came to pretty much everything about the event. So to have a car that was reliable was very important. And both our backgrounds have some areas that made us think about the reliability and how important it was. Fritz used to off-road race motorcycles. And I still do a bit race mountain bikes off-road. So we understand about the importance of durability of the vehicle you're either on or in. And we knew that was very important because if you don't finish, you don't win. So you have to get the car has to be durable.
You said that those first few days in China were an incredible learning experience. Was there a point on the journey when you thought, we're not going to make it?
No, I always thought we'd make it. I think we both thought we'd make it. There was a day when we came into in Russia. We came into a hotel at about 12:30 at night, and they'd already eaten. It was our headlights had shorted out during the day, and we didn't really have headlights that night. And we were driving 5 hours in the dark. And I think I'd passed the point of exhaustion. And when I think if someone had said, "Well, there's a bus out front. You can go to Paris on that bus." I think I might have boarded the bus that moment. But went to the room, took a shower, got up the next morning, and off we went. But I don't think we ever thought, no, we're not going to make it. I thought we always thought we would make it. And that's one thing about all these people. They had a resolve, the British resolve, I called it. And everyone was an individualist, and they were tough, and they were definitely going to make it.
Very impressive.
You talked about how it's very different to drive this kind of car across the countryside. You're going slow, so you really get to see things. But I would also think that there's a lot of noise and a lot of bumps. What is the experience like?
Well, of course, there are no windows, and there's no heater, and there's no power steering, and there's no air conditioning. The air conditioning comes from the outside, and we had 5 days of 35 degrees and rain. So the experience is that you're very cold or you're very hot. And you are bouncing a lot. In fact, I have trifocals in my glasses, and I don't think Lang I ever told you this, but the glasses would bounce up and down, so I'd get different vision all the time. And I had to put them down on my nose so I could look through the top of the glasses because it was so bouncy. And that this experience was just unbelievable. We said at the time, there's no way we're ever going to be able to describe this to people. And one of the things we regret that we didn't take more video. Our cameras have the capability of taking up to 40 minutes of video. And we did take some, but nowhere near what we should have, because that would have given people a little bit better impression.
How did you split up the driving?
Well, when we got just almost exhausted or so tired of it, sometimes it'd be 2 hours, sometimes it'd be 4 hours. Sometimes we'd beg to drive more because you get to hold on to the steering wheel. But, normally every 3 to 4 hours, that you're pretty well cooked out by that time and you need to take a break.
We had no routine. Of course, it was just starting. It had no routine. So we just kind of felt our way through on what seemed to fit best. And we recognized that Fritz is a better driver than I am. The car has a transmission in it that it's fully non-synchro and has to be double clutched, and downshifting is tricky business, and I never did figure that out very well when I was grinding gears and stuff. So Fritz did a much better job of that, and navigation was more of my strong point than Fritz's. So because of that, we chose our times when it was important to be the best navigator, and other times when it was really important to be the best driver. So it worked out very well in the long run.
We were talking.
Lang would always insist that he had to know where he was all the time, and I was busy looking at things going by and seeing yurts and people. And he would insist, "Where are we? Where are we?" And I said, "Why do you need to know that? You've got 24 more kilometers to go." But he finally said, "Okay, you got to stay on task." So I tried my best.
Well, that brings up an interesting question. We were talking earlier about the couple that was celebrating their 40th anniversary and that she said things to her husband she'd never said in 40 years. How did you guys get along on this journey?
Well, Lang is a terrific gentleman. Now I can just say that. And I think we both realized we had to do this, but it wasn't a real chore for us. I mean, we're easygoing people, and we just knew that every time we'd have a real hard thing, I would always say, well, that's why they call it the Motor Challenge. And we'd just kind of laugh and go on to the next thing. But I don't think we ever had a harsh word. We probably thought a little bit about it, but we never said anything. So I think it was just great. The only thing in the morning is I've been a little slower getting ready than Lang, and he would always be standing at the door watching his watch. And I'd say, well, just let me know what you want me to do. And what he said, well, you need to be ready the night before.
See, our goal on this thing was to finish. And also the secondary goal, or an important one too, was to try and get to the next overnight, whether it was a hotel or camping site, before dark. Because driving in the dark on an old gravel road somewhere is not a good thing. It's really tricky business. And putting up your tent in the dark is no fun either. So to get there before it got dark and when there was still food available was a big deal. We figured we won every day if we accomplished to get there before dark.
We actually would announce when we came in, we won. And everybody would say, you won what? Well, we won another day. We're here.
You started out in areas where there are vast stretches of land with not a lot of population. But, of course, as you moved on, you moved into more populated countries in Iran and Turkey, Greece, Italy, France. How did that change the drive to be places where I have a hard time imagining long stretches of dirt roads in France, for example?
Well, I think when we started out in China, there were just a ton of people. When we stopped for gasoline or stopped for lunch, 50 people would be there in a heartbeat just to see who we were, what we were doing, where we were from. And we were, almost like, we're a type of celebrities. They would drive along in their cars next to us and take pictures and things. And it was pretty chaotic, actually, because of all the attraction of our cars. When we got into Mongolia, there wasn't anything out there. I mean, it was, but there was very, very little. We'd go for an hour or so without seeing anything, people-wise. Even stopping in Mongolia, we'd stop for lunch, on the running board of our car, be eating a peanut butter sandwich, and all of a sudden some guy would come up on either on a motorcycle or on a horse and wonder if we were okay and, just really curious of what in the world we were doing out there. So we saw a little bit of everything.
And Mongolia was it was like being on Earth 5,000 years ago. We'd drive along for hours and hours and hours and just see one or two yurts with people. They had not donkeys, but they have a small horse and some goats, and that's it. Some cows, that's it. It was amazing. And we imagine that this is probably what the United States looked like before Europeans actually came here.
What was your highlight of the journey, both of you? Fritz, you can start.
Okay. Lang asked me that question the last day of our drive, and what I told him was it was, every day was a highlight. And every day was a highlight because there was such a diversity of people, cultures, scenery. I mean, we've never seen anything like this before. Going across rivers with our car and getting to see all these other people. I mean, you're really hard to find just one single thing. But the thing is, I really enjoyed the people that came on it. There were 23 countries represented, and mostly from UK. But we kidded with those people. We got to be friends with them. And I think I've never done anything that was so wonderful in my whole life. It was just a great experience to see this part of the country and part of the world. So there really wasn't. But if there's one thing, it was camping on those steppes in Mongolia along rivers. And just the beauty of the mountains around us. And sometimes there'd bring in some people, and they do horse races with kids. And put on some wrestling exhibitions for us. But the whole thing was just the most wonderful experience I think we've ever had.
How about you, Lang?
I totally agree with Fritz. I think the first and foremost was the interaction we had with all the people, our fellow rallyists, and also the people in the various countries we were in. That was just definitely the highlight. And then all the sights and sounds that we experienced, and specifically in Mongolia, was very special also.
We only have a moment left, but how do you think this experience changed you, Lang?
I think that we were gone on this thing for 37 days, and there were times during that that Fritz and I discussed what day of the week it was. It wasn't relevant to know whether it was Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday, and we lost. We were so consumed of getting from point A to point B. And that was a good thing, because it's very seldom you're able to step away from pretty much your life and have a different type of experience. So coming back to work and coming back to home and things, you're able to look at things in a little different perspective. And one of our goals is to try and hopefully keep that different perspective alive in the future.
Lang Whiteman and Fritz James, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Lang Whiteman and Fritz James returned in October from the Peking to Paris Motor Challenge. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Coming up in just a moment, we'll find out about the new documentary, Top Secret Rosies. I'll talk with the director, Leanne Erickson, about the film. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1942, just as the United States was entering World War II, a secret military program was launched to recruit female mathematicians to be human computers for the U.S. military. The story of these women is told in the new documentary, Top Secret Rosies. And here are the voices of a few of the women who served.
I was absolutely delighted. Yes, I did think it was an honor. I was thrilled. And I thought that this was just an unbelievable thing to do. Yeah, we knew we had to do it. We knew we had to help out. If we were sending our troops over there to risk their lives, we certainly had to help out on this end.
I minored in business, so I did learn adding machine. If all else failed, I could get a job in an office because I had shorthand and typing and that to fall back on.
I grew up in Missouri on a farm. I can remember in college, some guy asked me to marry him. I thought he was nuts. Why on earth would I want to get married? I haven't been anywhere. I haven't done anything. I wanted to get out of Missouri, and I wanted to go to some place, some big place.
Those are the voices of some of the women who served as human computers during World War II. Their story is told in the new documentary, Top Secret Rosies, and Leanne Erickson is the director of the film. She's based in Philadelphia, but she's originally from Iowa, from Waterloo, and went to school at UNI and also the University of Iowa later on. And she's touring the state right now, a couple of showings of the film coming up this week. We'll talk more about those in a little while. Leanne, where did you first learn about these women?
Yes, it was I stumbled upon them purely by accident. Even though I have a long history of being interested in women's history stories and World War II, I was working on another documentary in Philadelphia, and two of my subjects are the twins who appear in this documentary. And by accident, I was over at their house scanning some photos in for that documentary project. And they were just talking to each other, you know, looking at photographs and saying, now, was this when we were working for the Army over at UPenn? And I said, I interrupted them. I said, what are you talking about? Oh, when we were high school students, we were recruited right out of high school to work for the U.S. Army doing math. And I said, are you kidding me? I've never heard anything like this. After they told me the story, I said, listen, as soon as I'm done with this documentary, I'm coming back and we're going to do another one. And I don't know that they believed me, but I came back and we did another one.
Well, tell me about the program they were involved in, because there were women all over the country recruited that way. How did the program start?
Well, there were actually a number of different programs. And of course, each branch of the service had their own projects they were doing. And there were, as many people know now, a number of secret projects going on like Los Alamos and certainly the invention of ENIAC, the first electronic computer, that anywhere that there was some kind of a substantial math program at a university, probably people were there doing something for the war effort. I think we forget how much of a total war World War II is. We can kind of live our lives every day now, with even though we're fighting in two wars, and not even realize it, not think about it, where those folks every day they were doing something, you know, in terms of rationed food or gasoline or collecting scrap metal, or, you know, everybody, no matter what their age was, they were involved in some way. And so anybody who had these skills undoubtedly would be, you know, found and then recruited to try to do work. The particular program I'm concentrating on in the documentary was the program that was going on at the University of Pennsylvania.
Now, of course, we all of us are familiar, I think, with the history of Rosie the Riveter, that women were recruited into the workforce as men left to go right. And fight in World War II. And we do think about women entering these blue-collar jobs. But this is an opportunity for women who have more education to really contribute something to the war effort. How were these women recruited?
Well, it is a certain irony, you know, that we think of I think we all think probably that there were more limited opportunities for women in past decades, and I think we don't even realize actually how limited they were. For instance, in the 1920s, schools such as like the University of Chicago School of Engineering would have a cap. Only 5% women would be allowed to come into the program. So even if you were interested in math or science or engineering, you didn't necessarily have the opportunities. You know, just because you could afford to go to college didn't mean you would be allowed to study. And so, you know, there's no irony lost on me that when war breaks out all of a sudden and you see I looked at these ads in the Philadelphia Inquirer pre, you know, our involvement in the war, let's say like 1939 and 1940, you have employment ads that are, here's what's open for women, here are men's jobs. And the women's jobs are things like house cleaner, waitress, cook, those sorts of jobs. And as soon as we have Pearl Harbor in 1942, you see female engineers wanted. Now, where do we think we're going to find these people? And so they had to really dig around. And in the case of my women, like I said, the twins were 17 or 18 years old when they were recruited to do this right out of high school. So they hadn't even gone to college or studied math. But this was how desperate the need was. And they the U.S. Army would send out calls through the American Association of University Women, math organizations, directly to math programs, going to the high schools in Philadelphia. They really did whatever they could to try to find these women. It was a huge amount, really. During the course of the program, 80 to 100 women went through there as human computers.
When you say that they went to the high schools in Philadelphia, how did they identify these twins? Women with math aptitude, or
right? Yeah, they went. They approached the principals of the schools, and my twins had gone to Girls High, which was a public school, but it was somewhat of in those days a prep school. You had to take tests and try out to get in. People were selected, and the twins had been selected. But surely, one of the twins likes to tell the story of the reason why they had, you know, aptitude in math was because of their lazy brother. When they were in junior high, their brother was a math major at the University of Pennsylvania and didn't want to do his homework. So he supposedly showed his sisters how to do his homework, taught them, you know, college level math, which they were good at and they thought it was fun. And so when they went to Girls High, they joined the math club. They just purely did this as not because they thought to themselves, this is what I want to do when I go to college, but just because they were good at it. And then when the war, you know, came upon us suddenly, it's not as if we didn't know it. I think that there are certain circles of people who felt we should have gotten involved earlier, but it was just a matter of time. We'd be pulled in somehow, but it still was a surprise. And so they scrambled in those first 6 months of our involvement in the war to get things on the ground going. And one of the things was this desperate need all of a sudden for women who had these high-end skills, math, engineering, science, that sort of thing. And, you know, they were dogged. They found them, you know.
Once they identified these women, what was the next step?
Well, they tended to have to take math classes. And it would be in a very specific kinds of math, which is differential equations, ballistics, mathematics has to do with the idea of projectiles that fly through the air, and everything affects that. You know, the wind, atmosphere, the curve of the earth. There's all these variables that you have to take into consideration. So you create these tables in which then a military man who's, you know, part of, let's say, the artillery would have a sense of what they needed to set their weapon on in order to get this projectile to where they wanted it to land. And it was the women's mathematics that gave them those figures to work with.
So we've been calling them human computers. They were working on ballistics information. What exactly did they do on a daily basis?
Well, you know, you said we're calling them human computers, and in fact, that was up until 1946, when the first unveiling of ENIAC, which was an electronic computer. The term computer was actually the term used to describe a person whose job was to compute.
You didn't have to modify it with human.
No, no. We do that now. If you looked up in a dictionary in 1936, I'm sure under the word computer, it would say a person who does mathematics for a living, which is exactly what computers did. And so when these women were hired, their level was called junior computer. You know, I have all their documents, and that was their job title, if you will, so that they could move from junior computer to senior computer and so on, and go up in rank and money that they made as well. But no, these are long days. Certainly, they had 3 8-hour shifts. And so you shifted around depending on any kind of week that you did. They work 6 days a week. For the duration, I mean, that's what it says, indefinite appointment on their papers. And that to me is one of the most amazing things, because all these women willingly said, I'm going to put everything else I want to do on hold, and I don't know how long that's going to take. Nobody knew how long it would take us to win, you know, New World War II. And so they were there till the end. And they didn't – for 3 years, my twins worked there and never took a vacation, worked 6 days a week, sometimes double shifting and even triple shifting, sleeping, you know, when they could, because they had to churn out this material. An example that one of them gave as to, you know, you say to yourself, well, then why all of a sudden do we need all of this? And a good example that Marlon, one of the women, gave was one of the first things she worked on was the North Africa campaign. So that's in you know, like I said, spring, I guess, and into summer of 1942. So very early in the war, we realized that, you know, all of the calculations that had been done at Aberdeen Proving Ground for all our various weapons, howitzers and whatnot, done on solid ground, all of a sudden those figures don't work because we're shooting on sand, and sand gives. And so now all the ballistics tables have to be redone immediately because they're already there fighting. And so oftentimes Marlon said that's why they felt the pressure, is that they knew that these soldiers were there with our equipment trying to fight this war and didn't have the kind of information they needed to do the best job they could. So there was an urgency to the work that they did.
And you mentioned ENIAC, which was the first electronic computer, and these women actually were tapped to be the first programmers.
Some of them were, yes. It was because it makes sense, I think, if you think about it, that if you've got these women doing this particular job, then when you the inventors of ENIAC, Eckert and Mauchly, undoubtedly thought to themselves, okay, we've taken this process, which was done by hand, and actually I would say that ENIAC is modeled on the differential analyzer, which was a mechanical calculator, a huge beast of a calculator, 30 feet long, and some of the women worked on that machine as well, that he thought of a way to try to do this job electronically and needed the same kind of programmers. Women were programming problems into the differential analyzer, and then they needed them to do the same with ENIAC. And so the story goes that the call was put out and 13 women applied and 6 were chosen. Jean Bartik, one of my subjects, was one of the original 6 ENIAC programmers. And she tells a funny story about her interview, where she's sitting with, you know, Captain Herman Goldstein, who was the military man heading up the operation. He didn't know what to ask her because this is a job nobody's had before. And she said finally he asked her if she was afraid of electricity because they would be handling big cables and whatnot. And she said, well, not particularly. And he said, well, okay. And so it was, you know, some of this hit and miss kind of thing when you're inventing really a new job in a way. And certainly computer programming has changed in the years since. But it is pretty exciting to know that, and I hope that it would change some girls' minds about the idea of pursuing careers in math, science, engineering, and computers if they understood that in the earliest days of the computer, women were right there, right on the front lines there, helping make that possible.
And before we get calls or emails about it, the Atanasoff Berry computer was invented at Iowa State University.
Yes.
And was working before ENIAC.
Yes.
But this was part of the war effort and part of this history.
Yeah, it's a different project and different intention for the project.
Right.
ENIAC was meant as a way of doing differential equations faster, and it was considerably faster.
When the war ended, there are stories that have been told about women who had entered the workforce who were suddenly expected to go back to their homes and be homemakers and return to all of the roles that they held before World War II. What happened to the women who were part of this program?
I think, as always, when you have more flexibility, you have more opportunities. And these women actually had opportunities to stay with, for instance, ENIAC was unveiled after World War II because even though it was funded in hopes of helping win the war, it was not unveiled until the February of 1946 after the war was over with. However, it was an integral now piece of equipment being used for the atomic program that the military was going on. Of course, we left one war, a hot war, and went right into a cold war. And so the programmers stayed with it. If they wanted to, they stayed, and they did. And Marlon and Jean Bardick, Marlon Westhoff, she's one of the other women in my documentary. These were two of the six programmers, and they had the choices to do that. Nobody booted them out. Where this problem starts to happen is later on, I think, in the 50s, as we start to see the commercial application of the computer and those possibilities, then it becomes – now it's not just some kind of a clerical thing. It actually has – there's work to be done, and the women are starting to be replaced by men and being pushed out. And in maybe one of the saddest elements of the story, Jean Bardick, who was a true pioneer and has been publicly recognized as one, helped do the programming for UNIVAC and BINAC. I mean, we're talking right on the ground floor of commercial computing. When it came time, she had married, and she and her husband both worked for Remington Rand, the corporation at that time. And when they passed a rule that husbands and wives could not both be employed by the company, they let her go and not him. And this becomes very commonplace, not even a question thing. Of course, this would happen. But so I think that there was that opportunity right at the initial onset that women were involved. But as we move away from the need of World War II, the women start to get pushed out just slower. I think it still happens.
Right now, you're on a tour funded by a grant from the American Association of University Women. So you get to travel with this film. It's going to be shown tonight in Iowa City, tomorrow night in Grinnell.
Mm-hmm.
What is your hope for the film as time goes on?
It is. I do have a hope that it has this educational impact. It has been picked up for distribution by PBS, and so therefore it's available to home video people. They could just go to shoppbs.org. But on the other hand, it's also available to libraries and schools and educational, high schools and any kind of educational groups. And that, I think, is really important because it allows us to reach those students that I'm hoping that we can reach.
Lori Erickson is the director of the film Top Secret Rosies, which tells the story of a group of female mathematicians who did secret research for the U.S. Army during World War II. You can see the film tonight in Iowa City at the Siemens Center for Engineering Arts and Sciences at 6:30. The showing starts at 7 o'clock tomorrow night at the Grinnell College Alumni Recitation Hall at 7 p.m. We'll put those details up on our website and our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.